Hi, I'm David Fleming. I'm the composer for Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Damsel, which I think we're here to talk about both of them today.
Yeah, well, Dave, it's so good to see you in person.
You too.
For the first time in a few years, so yeah.
Yeah, it's weird to like, I mean, I've gotten so used to like Zoom meetings and Zoom interviews that
and it's because I think the last time we actually did in person was I think Blue Planet 2 with you and Jacob, which was actually
a
long time ago.
Yeah, that is a while ago. Yeah.
But so we did just speak recently for Last of Us, just I think last year.
Yeah.
So we did talk a bunch of stuff there, but just I forget if I asked you back then because I know you recently became a dad. So I guess we'll just start off like congrats first of all to you and your wife.
Yeah, I mean, thank you very much. he's almost 2.5 now, so yeah, honestly, it's like the most boring thing that everyone says about how fast it goes, but like usually I track time by how many projects I've been working on.
Yeah.
And now it seems like the equation has changed or something. It just has gone into turbo drive.
Have you found a good work-life balance now you have a child? Did it kind of throw a wrench into the pattern of late nights and stuff like that? Or
it does in that he wakes up consistently between 5 and 6 every day, and those are very important hours. But as far as balance, no, it's still a work in progress trying to figure that out. I will say one thing about having kids, if any composers are afraid of having kids, at least for me, the one nice thing to find was, you know, when you're with your kid, you're not stressing about other things.
Yeah.
Which
your intention is focused.
Which is fantastic. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm loving it.
That's amazing. Well, since I wanted to ask you because we did do an interview for The Last of Us, and it had the reaction to that series was amazing. So after the series came out, and after, because you worked with Gustavo, well, you didn't work with him. You guys worked separately, but the series as a whole was so well received. I'm curious what it was like to see all that feedback and just the love for the series.
Oh yeah, that was amazing. I mean, I feel very lucky to have gotten that call and to be, you know, it's Gustavo's baby. He's been shepherding the musical identity of that franchise for such a long time, and he's written such beautiful music. I was so happy to be able to be a part of it and hopefully, you know, add a little bit to it. But no, I mean, it was just fantastic. The fans of that show are so passionate.
Very.
And I'm one of them. the fans of the video game.
The game, yeah. Really. I'm a game. I love the games. Yeah.
But it was really interesting to see how, you know, you just by embracing that game that they got all these new fans as well of the show. And I think Craig and Neil did a really good job of kind of adding a dimension to the story.
You Absolutely. Know? Yeah. Do we know season 2? Or are you?
I've heard some rumblings, but I think they've got bigger fish to fry right now, and there's a lot of story, you know.
Yeah, they're playing catch up after the strikes and everything. So
yeah. But I'm very excited, and it's fantastic.
Cool.
What an amazing story.
Yeah, your music complemented Gustavo's perfectly, and you added, you know, the tension and the action stuff, which is, I mean, masterclass in like tension and thrilling and this.
I said it was like my job seemed to be like panic attack.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
every episode.
Your tracks were all like, panic attacks.
Like what version of panic attack can we accomplish here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I do want to mention because you also did a score, Americana, with film starring Sydney Sweeney, but it hasn't gotten distribution yet, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the deal is. It debuted at South by Southwest
last year, right?
And it had a good reception.
Yeah, everyone was talking great about the film.
I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with it. Bronze Studios was the studio that produced it, and I know they're having some difficulties. So hopefully it all comes together because it's really Tony Toast, the director.
Yeah.
He just, you know, that story is like in his bones. And when he came to me, he wanted to do this country western score. Like he, you know, it was so interesting talking to him because, you know, you get so used to people telling you Star Wars is their favorite score, or you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, which are great, but he was like, my favorite score is Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which Bob Dylan
did the
score for.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how it worked though, because you know, if you listen to it, like the song "Knocking on Heaven's Door" is from that movie.
Right.
So I don't know if he wrote some songs and then they stripped down to instrumentals or something, but
yeah, I thought it was all songs. Yeah, I thought it was just he wrote songs.
Yeah, I think
they scored it with songs.
Yeah,
but they used some instrumental stuff. I haven't seen him in a long time.
But it was just so interesting talking to Tony, and like that's his high watermark.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to kind of approach that score in a similar way, and yeah, I got to record pedal steel and all sorts of things, and yeah, so I really hope they figure out the distribution.
Yeah, and that's my favorite genre, like Western and just different takes on Westerns and modern Westerns and all these neo-Westerns. So yeah, I hope it comes out, because it definitely got buzz around it.
And yeah.
But it's, you know, industry the way it is now, getting distribution sometimes or getting it out, you know, so.
Yeah. We'll see.
Well, I want to jump right into Mr. and Mrs. Smith before we get to Damsel. So congratulations on the score.
Thank you.
In the series, it's fantastic.
Thanks.
So, of course, I think a lot of people remember the Doug Liman film, which John Powell scored. So this is definitely has a different feel, different tone. Yeah. So I'm curious, what were the first conversations about the score, and how did you guys want to make this unique and not kind of in the shadow of the film?
Yeah. I mean, thankfully for me, and for the show, I think that, you know, Donald and Francesca Salone, the showrunner, really wanted to do something a lot different than the film. So I was never being asked to be John Powell, which was a huge relief for me, because he's incredible. But also, you know, I think it allowed me to lean into what I like to do, which is make something a little bit different. And, you know, they wanted it to be big, they wanted it to be exciting, but they were very specific about, like, let's not do it in the obvious way.
Right.
Francesca was, she said something early on that she was like, what's the art school version of this scene? Like, how could we do this in an art school way? So, like, art school kind of was always in my head of, okay, yes, this is a big budget show, but if we were doing this on, like, a shoestring with our friends and just trying to be weird and kind of fun, how would we do this? So yeah, I mean, they didn't have a lot of idea about the actual sound of the music, but they really were keyed into kind of what made their John and Jane really interesting and different. And you know, they're not like practice spies. They are not Brad Pitt. They are not Angelina Jolie. And they really wanted to lean into that.
She always described it as it's a love story at heart.
And that was what, you know, Donald very early on was like, I think this show is about trust.
Yeah.
The show is about trusting another person. And so, you know, I think what I was trying to do was always root the music in their relationship.
Yeah.
Of course there's like crazy missions and things that we go on, but essentially you know, the music, you know, the ambition was to kind of make the adventure one and the same, the sort of the trusting each other and both in both their like professional partnership and then as they grow into this romantic relationship as well.
Yeah. And, you know, no spoilers or anything, but the season is definitely designed with a little bit of an ambiguous ending.
Right.
So I'm curious, it did feel like a full closure, but also can leave it open for to continue. So I'm curious how you structured the whole season. Did you try to create it like one big long film? Did you kind of just treat episode as chapters? I'm curious how structurally did you score it?
as structurally as I could manage, given that it was very much like running and gunning and kind of like simultaneously experimenting and executing. It was helpful in that the first thing they showed me was the first episode and the last episode. So I at least had an idea of like, okay, this is where they start and this is where they go.
Yeah.
So I kind of had an idea of like the emotional stakes needed. But also the first episode specifically, they are so like awkward with each other, and it sets this really kind of offbeat tone. Like it's not a perfect meet cute. It's not, they're not perfect spies. They're even in their relationship. It's not, it's, there is no kind of like hit by the lightning bolt moment. They're
and
really,
you, I think you mentioned that the first episode is a little bit slower paced too. So kind of, you kind of slow burn into it.
Yeah. So I think deliberately, like Hiro Murai, who directed the first two episodes.
It was fantastic. Because amazing. He did, This Is America, the
yeah,
music video.
Yeah. And he did a lot for Atlanta and just brilliant, brilliant director. I think the idea was that when it finally does kind of get loud, it gets really loud, and it sort of shocks you because it has this pace of like, oh, we're just watching like a romantic show. We're watching two people on like a blind date in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when it kicks in, it's you're not sure if it's going to kick in. Yeah, spoiler alert, it does. but I think what makes the show special is that, you know, even once it does kick in, is exciting and it is action packed, but it's always kind of rooted in figuring out their relationship and like the next step, and it's very relatable for that reason. Like, I think it's a great show for couples to watch because you can recognize all of these kind of milestones of relationships.
Yeah, and I feel like the characters are a little bit more relatable versus Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, where it's like you're watching movie stars kind of being in an action film, and it's more conceptual, where this feels like it's really building around them as a relationship and putting the action kind of around them.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was really important. I'm assuming that's why, you know, Donald and Francesca chose to kind of take it on, because they knew that they had this angle at it. You know, I mean, it turns the premise on its head, and it's really about, you know, they know they're spies from the beginning. They know they're assassin spies, whatever. And the relationship sort of happens accidentally almost.
Yeah.
I think they were really smart to approach it that way. I mean, within, it's funny because the show starts with sort of a cold open that you almost think like, oh, okay, maybe I am watching something like the original Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yeah.
And then it just switches gears really quickly. So
yeah,
I
love it when a show can subvert expectations, and because I think we watch so much stuff these days and we have kind of the formulas in our head, and when creators and directors and editors can find a way to kind of guide the audience and be like, nope, that's not what you thought it was.
Yeah. Like, yeah. That's the point of why I think, you know, subverting expectations is almost too easy in that, like, you can destroy the old thing. And I think there's something so classic about their approach and the way it looks and the way it feels and hopefully the way it sounds, to an extent, that there is love there in the the modernization of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Was it hard to find, like, balance the characters and the action, or did you find it hard to kind of have the characters exist within the music, or was it kind of you were able to find your palette and find your kind of structure pretty easily in terms of balancing character and the plot?
I would say it was really the tone that was like, it was trying to figure out a tone that could work and not, and as soon as you got into action, it didn't feel like, oh, where are we going now?
Right.
It was really about finding like a musical language that seemed to be able to fit the spy story, but also their relationship. There were times, I will say, where like in episode 3, where they go skiing, which was directed by Karina Evans, and is just beautiful. It's so gorgeous to look at that I think like I got. I remember one draft where we just started going like full Bond and like full cheeky and like getting too cute. And that was like realizing that we need to stay with John and Jane the whole time. And that if you start getting like swept away by the genre elements, then you're going to go off course. And you need to stick with their relationship. And then usually if I did that, then we were okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the show, I think, turned out amazing, and it feels like its own thing, and it just feels like, I think the characters are the strength of it for sure. And the acting is fantastic. And I think your score fleshed all of that out. So yeah, congrats.
Thank you.
But speaking about subverting genres and stuff, like, I mean, I want to jump into Damsel next. So First of all, congrats on being able to tackle something that's just like, it is genre, but it's I mean, even the trailer says it's not a fairy tale, and it is like kind of, and you got to write some amazing themes and melodies. And I'm curious, first of all, how did you get attached to this project? Because I think the director, Juan Carlos Fresnadillo, like, I mean, he directed 28 Weeks Later, and his career, he's kind of taking breaks between movies and stuff. So it's not often where he makes something. So how did you get attached with this project?
Yeah, they were trying to figure out something musically, and I know they had approached Hans for a recommendation, and ended up taking a meeting with JC, with Juan Carlos.
Yeah.
And I think we just hit it off right away. And it's funny to be talking about the subverting of expectations, because what I was led to believe sort of starting to talk to him was was that he wanted to subvert all expectations, and maybe they were going for something that was quite crazy.
Yeah.
But when I started talking to him, I realized that, you know, he really wanted the music to not be in a similar way to Mr. and Mrs. Smith, that he really wanted it to be like a loving fantasy score as well.
It feels like you did embrace it, though. It feels like you embraced the genre and embraced the, you know, kind of the what we might expect a little bit, but like it is different, though.
We have our spin on it, but it was a little bit of a relief that he didn't want to make, like, I don't know, like a dubstep or like...
like a Cliff Martinez, like something.
I mean, I love Cliff.
He got hired for Game Night, which was a perfect thing of juxtaposing that, where you have this great, you know, electronic score for this kind of comedy, kind of heist thing, but it works. But like,
and it was just so funny because I was expecting this one thing when talking to him, and he just started talking. He's just like, I just love the orchestra. I just really want to use the orchestra. And I was like, oh. Okay, yeah, me too. Like, I you know, it's, honestly, it's, I love doing Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and I love doing Last of Us, and it's so fun leaning into this one side of my musical personality, but also, like, there is a side of me that, when I was younger, especially, was like, I just want to do, like, a big fantasy score, so...
And it felt... From the tracks you sent me, it transported me back. Like the way you wrote it was like the style that I think that we grew up watching those films, and it felt, I don't know, there was a lot of love. I felt.
It was like, I was, you know,
I was like, oh, Dave is having a great time with this.
For sure. There was so many times where like, I can't believe they're letting us do this.
Yeah.
You know? But it was all, you know, it was all JC as well, because there were times where, you know, especially like with the dragon, where maybe, you know, I would go very sound designy, and he would sort of pull me back and say, like, how could the orchestra do this? And it was like, it was an unusual and kind of really like lovely surprise to be working with a director who wasn't scared of melodies and tunes and big orchestra. Which is understandable right now, because the way things are being shot, you know, and by the way, it's not a judgment, because I can see the shift in a lot of filmmaking. So it can be like a big change when all of a sudden you're used to having temp score, and then you plop like a big tune on something, or you know, something that's very sort of melodic.
Yeah.
I think a lot of directors can you know, kind of wince at it at first. And he was kind of always just like, you know, as big and romantic as we could make it. That was right up his alley.
So did it take a while to find, I guess, the right sound for it? Like, how did you want it to make it classic, but also put your own spin on it? Was there any certain techniques you did that, in terms of instrumentation or anything, to not only kind of touch on the whole fairy tale aspect of it, but make it unique to what this story is? And kind of, it is a dark kind of, you know, more, you know, she's being sacrificed into the thing, and she has to survive. So it's a completely kind of wild ride where she has to, you know, pretty much rely on herself to get out of the situation. But so I'm curious, it seems like a very simple and intimate story with this character, but against this huge kind of canvas and backdrop. So I'm curious, was it hard to find how big or how intimate to make the score and the melody so they're not too, I guess, grandiose or kind of overshadowing?
I don't know if I thought about overshadowing it, but it was, you know, I did something really kind of stupid at first, which is like the first thing you always want to present is like, this is my main character theme. In this case, Elodie, Millie Bobby Brown's character. And I had this like really strong feeling that she should have two themes. And the reason being is like, it's a big, you know, dragon movie. It's about fighting a dragon. Yes. And it's a popcorn-y movie, but like to me, when I first saw it, and maybe it's just my take on it, but I had this like really, this like deep feeling that it was this very existential kind of film about growing up and about, you know, the dragon being something inside of yourself that you have to kind of explore and tame and make a part of you. And so it was very important to me that, you know, Elodie had this outward looking thing, I called it the horizon theme, which was, you know, she's going on this adventure. She's really excited. She's going to be a princess. And there is this optimism in her, but there's also this, like, there's this thing that deep down she has to confront. And so there ended up being these two themes for her that was, and it was kind of about balancing those. And they both came fairly quickly, and it was really just about that risky first meeting of playing it back and being like, okay, here's two things, and I think they both should be valid. And then, of course, at the end, they start to work together. And then the dragon was a different thing. The dragon was really interesting because I would say Elodie was very well defined in the film, and the dragon was the thing that maybe changed the most from the time I started and the time I finished. And it's a really interesting character and the way they present it. And I don't want to ruin anything about it, but it needed to have a lot of layers. And in terms of the sound of it, that was one that, you know, we approached in a lot of different ways, and there are a lot of sound design elements to the dragon, but it's always sort of featuring the orchestra. The other thing I should mention is that we, and I have to give credit to my old boss, Atli Orvison, composer I came up under, because we worked on the score, The Eagle.
I love The Eagle.
A while ago, and he introduced me to this musician, John Kenny, who plays this instrument called the Carnyx, which is this ancient like war horn. And I knew it would be the perfect sound to kind of add to the dragon, to give it this, we already had a theme and everything, but it needed this like very kind of ancient and primal kind of feeling. And if you see the instrument, it's like, it looks like a dragon. It's this giant thing with this tongue and everything. And it's absolutely insane.
Is it fun when you get to work with like a solo musician like that? I mean, that must be great to like experiment and find things and almost like you're like a director. You're probably directing him and try this and probably let him improvise a little bit too.
There was a lot of that. And he's like a character. He's a very academic kind of guy. He really is a scholar of these instruments. He's not just a player. So there was an element of like, hey, can you play these crazy sounds? But it was also like a bit of like history class. Like, before I play this, I'm going to explain everything about it. And it was great to have that context. But it was fantastic. So you know, it really became about balancing the sort of traditional sounds with new sounds. I also brought in this guitarist, Yvette Young, who's just this amazing kind of like post emo. I don't know. She'd probably not like that description. She's got this incredible style, yeah. That and she just has this this sound that I thought would be a really great layer. So we have this like really ancient sound, and then sort of towards the end of the film we get some new sort of electrified sounds as well.
Was it intimidating writing music for a dragon? Because I feel like dragons have been so big in pop culture since Game of Thrones, and you know, you have How to Train Your Dragon, and of course, you know, even House of Dragon. Dragons are in the fantasy kind of always being talked about. So was it like, how do I make this stand out like from everything else?
I didn't think about everything else, but I really thought about like their take on this dragon. Yeah. There's like this emotional core to it, and whereas I think in other things, like the dragon is, you know, like a sort of big beast.
Yeah, it's like a monster. Or, it's a monster film.
Yeah, or like a lovable friend, like in How to Train Your Dragon. Yeah. It's in this one, it's kind of a tragic figure.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I can talk about the story, right? It's like...
Yeah, you can talk. I mean, you know, we're going to release this after, probably.
Okay, okay,
yeah.
Good.
So, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, because we're saving it, right?
Like, yeah. It's got... It there's this tragedy rooted in its three children, and the number three became kind of an obsession point with me, because it's an obsession point with this dragon, and how that's rooted in the ritual that Millie Bobby Brown's character goes through. And so it kind of became about like how to make musically this like obsessive state that this dragon has, and, yeah, and how it's actually like rooted in a quite sad story. It's a different dragon than I think you're used to.
I think for sure, because I think dragons are always like this obstacle at the end of the, and you know, the final boss or whatever kind of type of thing.
Well, that's the other thing. I saw it like,
yeah, you mentioned it was her.
I saw it as a part of her.
Yeah, you know? Part of her. Like she's facing her own demon almost in a sense.
Yeah, and there's something that links them. There's sort of a tragedy, a betrayal that links both of them. So, I saw it as kind of inextricable from Elodie and. There's peripherally sort of mention of Elodie's mother and how that works in, and I don't know. I was kind of in, like you said, I was obviously having fun, and yeah. I was like, well, what if it's this? What if it's that? I would tell JC, the director, I was like, maybe this tune is the lullaby her mom used to sing her, and there was a lot of conceptual stuff that only matters to me, maybe.
Right.
But it certainly made it fun to kind of key into the story that way.
So you mentioned you were talking about kind of finding the sound and finding the palette. When you first presented to JC, like the first piece of music you write, is that still like a nervous thing to do when you're presenting to a director, especially around doing this kind of big fantasy film? Like like, what are they about?
Has anyone ever said no to that question to you? It's like the most nerve-wracking thing in the world. Yeah, I mean, even presenting to my wife, you know, honestly, who worked with me as a score supervisor.
Yeah, she works with you, yeah.
She's always like the first person I run things by, and it's always a nerve-wracking experience playing something for her. It's just like, you know, of course you feel strongly about something when you make it, but like hearing it, even when somebody's sitting in the room with you, you start to hear it differently. And...
Oh, 100%. Because you like, it's like weird. Like you put yourself in their body somehow. It's like you're sitting there and you're like in their mind. Like I'll do that too when I'm finishing up something and I'm like, I'm imagining this playing to someone else and what they would, I'm like trying to like get in touch with them spiritually, like to feel what they're feeling, not what like you feel.
Yeah. No, it's odd. I mean, it's what's nice about watching movies with an audience too.
Yeah.
I just experienced that with Dune the other day, kind of seeing that even everyone in the audience was people who worked on it, but it's just like a completely different film.
You know? Oh yeah, I mean, I always say, like, it's different when you see a comedy in a theater with a sold out crowd versus at home when you're by yourself. And it's funnier. Horror movies are scarier when you're in a crowd with everybody. Or
yeah.
Action movies are more thrilling when everyone's like...
on an airplane that you're crying at 27 Dresses or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's crying.
I can never watch movies on airplanes, like, no matter what. I always just watch, like, old TV that I've seen a thousand times before. I can't, because it's like the screen sucks. Like, it's like the same. I'll watch something that I've seen before. I'll never watch something for the first time on an airplane. Because I feel like it's...
That's so funny.
I'm such a snob, but when it comes to, like, presentation, I need my surround sound. And
okay, I'm like that too, but I think there's a certain, like, kind of movie that really lends itself to that setting. Yeah, I agree. Like, the big action movies I would rather watch at home or in a theater, but...
Yeah, I guess, like, a rom-com or a comedy is fine.
I'm trying to think about, like...
what was a movie that... is there something that you saw for the first time on an airplane? Like, I'm going to check this out on my, like, 8-hour flight or whatever if you're going to London or something.
Okay, I'm not going to say what movie it is because it was like a rom-commy type of movie.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I saw it and I was, you know, I was like so moved by it and I was so affected. I was on my way home, you know, for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
And I got home and I was like telling my family, I was like, oh yeah, I'm going to watch this movie. And they were all like, we watched the movie, it was a piece of shit. Like, I was like,
I cried.
No, it was great. It was so good. Yeah, no, I don't know. It's there. I think there is definitely like a class of like plane movie that's so enjoyable.
I get. Yeah, I can see
when
that.
You're up in the air.
Yeah. Okay. I can see it.
Yeah. Come on, Kaya.
I need my Atmos, Dave.
You have
Hans will yell at me. Yeah, I have the.
I don't think Hans. I think he watches a lot of stuff on his iPad. I don't think he...
Oh, no, but I remember he's so precious about his Atmos mix, especially for Dune.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, yeah. Well, you have to experience... Dune is a different story.
Yeah. Oh, no, Dune, yeah, completely different story. Yeah. But, no, I have the... I don't have, the ceiling-mounted speakers. I have, like, these tall boys that have the firing up ones that are supposed to reflect down, which is fine for a small space. It's not, of course, not going to mount speakers yet, but...
Yeah.
But it gets the job done. So I got my OLED, I got my... pseudo Atmos. But
yeah, we have a projector set up at home and the past 2 years has been a lot of bluey on the projector.
Oh yeah, you're not, in those ages.
Not
yeah.
a lot after that. So
you're so what else besides bluey have you been watching?
Charlie Brown Christmas.
Charlie Brown.
From the 60s, which he's obsessed with, and Miss Rachel. Yeah, so like all, you know, the big 4K blockbusters.
You got to start them young, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Throw on some Hitchcock. Traumatize.
I played him Lady and the Tramp, and that was like too much.
Too much.
I was like,
yeah.
This is scary.
Yeah, those old Disney stuff. Like,
yeah, they know how to manipulate the.
Yeah, I mean, I've grown up with Secret of Nim, having nightmares.
Oh, and... that one really is scary. Yeah.
Yeah, the old Don Bluth stuff is dark.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for in terms of just your general approach, I feel like we've probably touched upon this many times, but. At least with Damsel, what was the starting point for you? Did you just start writing? So, I mean, when you get a project, is the second you get the call saying you're hired, like, is your mind already cooking things up, or do you wait till you're like, I guess, in a creative space?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's like a lot of excitement, and then I think a like subconscious cooking up and like procrastination for that certain one the main tune I had pretty quickly and then the secondary tune I kind of came up with in Australia too. It was actually really nice to not be in my studio. And
Christmas, you're with your family, like you're just away from work, like.
Well, sort of. I was finishing the last. Last of Us episode at the same time, so I had my like mobile rig with me, but it was kind of a pain to set up, and it was sort of set up for Last of Us. It was all like crazy sound design and all that. So kind of being forced to work on just this little electric piano that was in the room. Kind of simplified it, you know. It was like, okay,
back to basics,
just basics, like, you know, find some tunes. So it was really nice actually to have that time to not be able to go to my studio and think about it, and some of those ideas became things, and some you know became nothing, but
yeah,
that's all.
And did you come on late on the project, or were you early enough to read the script, or did you just start with a locked picture?
No, it wasn't locked. There's still a lot of changes, but I would say relatively late, in that there was an assembly, and I think they had tried some things musically, mm-hmm. But no, I mean, JC's vision, Juan Carlos's vision was pretty clear, and everything kind of ended up going back to the first conversation that I had with him,
yeah.
Which is just like, I could just tell that he had this story kind of, he's a very like instinctual and like emotive kind of filmmaker, and
yeah.
You know, he wasn't interested in tricks, you know, he wanted something that felt, you know, classic and sincere, I think.
Yeah. Did you have enough time to experiment, or was
yeah.
it?
Yeah. 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 Actually, that was the nice surprise, is that I thought I wasn't going to have time when yeah. I first got the job, but for a myriad of reasons, they ended up pushing a bit. So yeah, I can't complain about time on this one. It was really nice. Got to go, record orchestra in London twice.
And, wow.
Fantastic choir, fantastic brass section.
Yeah, you had some amazing choir in the score. So that must have been fun to record that.
Yeah, that was great. What we did is we did sort of two choirs. We did a big, standard choir, big mm. fuck-off choir, I call it. and then we also, I had this idea to do this, what we called like the Phantom Princess Choir, mm-hmm. which is, there are these spirits that kind of assist Elodie. Obviously she's not the first person to kind of suffer this fate.
Right.
And
she's in a lineage of people sacrificed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is this, what we ended up doing is taking nine singers, because there's always groups of three,
mm-hmm.
nines and threes everywhere. We recorded them in a smaller room, and although they sang as a choir, they were each like sort of sectioned off so that we could like pan their voices around and use them a little bit more,
yeah.
like an effect, and because they are this like ghostly presence. So that was really fun. That was like a great addition to it. And it sort of sits on top. So you have the big choir, which is there for all the glory and on all that. But then you also have this kind of like warning to Elodie all the time that mm. this stranger, and all, it's all very close mic'd, and they're singing with a raspy voice, and it's yeah. never like, I wanted them to each have individual voices and not blend.
Right. Right, right. Yeah. Is there a sequence in the film that's like, something that you look back on that you're like really, I'm sure you're proud of the whole score, but is there one that was yeah. just like really fun? Like, was it in a certain sequence or a certain act of the film or a certain reel? I'm curious, is there something that you look back on and go, oh, that was, I love that section.
Oh yeah. I mean, there, it changes, but, definitely, there's a piece of music that's used, both when she comes into the kingdom, and I'm maybe just thinking about it because of those voices, they sort of serve as this warning. It's like this, you know, glorious kingdom, and everything is like, oh, this is going to be amazing, it's going to be like a fairy tale, but yeah. there's also this kind of like creepy vocal thing that happens, and it happens again. It's probably my favorite scene in the film, of they're dressing Elodie for her wedding, and it's obviously this like exciting ritual, but mm. Juan Carlos wanted to have this ominous presence as well, of like, how do we get her dressed up and ready to be a princess, but also make it feel really uneasy and
yeah.
like, this is not going to be right. Obviously, like the trailer,
it's not going to be a happy wedding or anything like that.
But we need to believe that, you know, there's a part, and that's why it was so important to me that she had this like this optimism mm-hmm. and like, well, maybe this is going to be my life. Maybe I am going to be this this princess, but also this kind of, you know, you can tell she always has this feeling that something's not quite right.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the score is fantastic. I mean, congratulations.
Thanks,
on getting to
thank you.
to do something like that, which is pretty rare, I think, today to get a project like this.
I did not take it for granted. I was enjoying it thoroughly the entire time. And yeah, definitely my like 12-year-old self was like, you know, jumping for joy. It was insane.
Absolutely. And if, yeah, I know Netflix sometimes will release stuff in theaters for, so I would definitely would say go see this if you can see it, if you get a chance to see it in the theater.
I hope so. Yeah, yeah, I hope they do. That would be nice.
But in terms of, I guess, you know, maybe just talking about your general approach, and maybe not even focusing on Damsel, but like what happens? Do you ever get like writer's block? Do you ever sit down and go like, fuck, I can't come up with anything today? Like, and I'm curious, like, do you have like a routine to be like, I'm going to go for a walk, or I need to just go eat lunch and distance myself for it? Or does it, it's just more like procrastinating versus like remedying the situation?
The procrastinating is definitely a part of it. And people in my life will tell you that, whether it's people who work with me or my wife, you know, but yeah, there is like a panic cycle of you know, getting excited about an idea, worrying about it, getting a little something, feeling like you're done. Oh no, I don't have enough. I certainly envy people who it seems to kind of flow out of more. There is a lot of banging your head against the wall, but that's kind of always been the process for me. You know, even making music like for fun, it's always very similar. So,
can you still make music for fun, or is it still?
I mean,
or is it more like because there's so much of you're working on these projects, there's so much budget, everything is relying on this thing, and is it the weight of that ever always crushing you down, or can you put that aside and be like, let me just create, you know?
That's an interesting question. It was funny. Someone gave me shit about. Someone gave me shit about one of the other interviews where I was like, it is fun. It is fun, but my type of fun also involves a lot of pain and getting through the process.
Yeah, of course, that's part of it.
It is fun at the end of the day, but there are times where it certainly, you know, feels like, okay, every other project has been fun, but this is the one where I am not going to have a solution. And the one thing that helps me through that is like either me or someone I love reminding me that's like, oh no, you've been in this situation almost every single other time. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Where you, you know, where you think all is lost.
But I feel like I'm sure, I don't know if it's like this with you, but like when you're in it, it's like, you've never done it before. It's like, you forget everything that you've been through in the past. And it feels like this is like I can't do it. Like I'm in crisis mode again.
There's always a point. There's always a point. And usually it's right before you do figure it out or figure out the next solution, I think. I'm sure it's different for everyone. But yeah, to me, it's hard to extract that from the process.
And,
and feeling like I've exhausted all the bad ideas first, all the bad ideas in the world, hopefully. But, you know, it's also a process of collaboration too. And like, I love working with other people. You know, I come up from teams and, you know, I have great people that I've worked with before. Like, it's nice being able to call on people to give you another perspective.
Absolutely.
On things. Yeah. And, you know, like, everyone I've worked with, whether Last of Us or Mr. and Ms. Smith or Damsel, are all guys I've worked with in the past, and it's really nice to have the support of people, you know, talented people who can, you know, who have great ideas and also can kind of filter your great ideas. You know, there's so many times on Mr. and Mrs. Smith because we had like no time where we'd have these like, little focus groups, and it was like me, Forrest, Aldo, Jake, and there would be a lot of like me playing things and being like, is this shit? And and just trusting people to have your back. And it's an experience that I've enjoyed being a part of, you know, with Hans or Otley or Steve Jablonski, like of feeling like there is that your back is had and that.
Yeah, it takes a village. I mean, and also, even though writing is a very solitary process, but I think the having, I think people forget that it, you know, I think people think of like the composer locked away writing by themselves and coming out at the last second. Everything is done all by themselves. And I always see doing interviews and kind of talking to composers, I've noticed, I realized that this is like a microcosm of just like the production side of it. Like a director has their support team and they can't do everything on their own. They're relying on their DP, their editor, their costume designer, their production designer. And composers, you're almost like a musical director. You're writing the music, but you have additional help. You have, you know, orchestrators, you have technicians, you have additional writers, and it becomes this collaborative thing that it's so beautiful. And I think it's, I love the collaborative aspect of filmmaking. It's like, it always takes me back to film school. Like, again, like we mentioned earlier, it's like with Mr. and Mrs. Smith, what would it be like if you're just making stuff with your friends, you know? And it's just like, you know, I'm always trying to chase that, like, you know?
And it's great seeing when you mentioned Mr. and Mrs. Smith, like the whole team came, you know, they would come to the studio and talk to me, and they had clearly like formed such a bond being on set and trying to figure things out. And it was so, and I think it was a better show because of that. So it's something I, you know, especially having come up in that sort of, in that school of doing things, it's something I really embrace and yeah, I love it.
Yeah. Well, I want to, congrats on Damsel. Congrats on Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Thank you. Thanks, man.
You've been, you know, kicking ass lately, and it's so great to hear your solo projects and that you're still, you know, still working with Hans too. Dune 2, you're part of the Dune 2 crew. So,
yep.
So you're a busy guy, and it's just, you know, Dave, it's been great just listening to your stuff as your career is kind of just like really kind of in, you know, overdrive right now. So it's been great to catch up with you and,
thanks, man.
And talk. And we'll do it again on the next one.
Sounds good.
Cool.
All right, man.